Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the May 7th broadcast of Italian Tomatoes. Everyone, welcome to Italian Tomatoes. It's Thursday, May 7th, and tonight we're just doing a special on the British election. The structure of the show is going to be very informal. For most of the show, I'm going to just play the live feed from ITV, which is covering the election, and occasionally interrupt with my own remarks and a little background information. The chat is open. If you wish to participate in the chat, to call into the show, the number is 646-478-0004. That's 646-478-0004. Like I said, the agenda is very informal tonight. The election results are just going to speak for themselves. I would preface that with saying that this election is obviously important for the United Kingdom, but it's also very important for Americans to have some awareness of it, because there are themes that are emerging in this election that are very relevant to U.S. politics, and in particular, what happens when the two-party system breaks down and parties can't hold their coalition together and they start splintering into subgroups, which is definitely what has been happening in Great Britain tonight. Right now, it looks like the Conservative Party is going to be the biggest party in Parliament. It probably fall just short of a majority, which means in all likelihood David Cameron will return as Prime Minister with either a formal or informal coalition to maintain a working majority and stay in power. But it's there are, I think, 600 some seats that have to be counted, and that process doesn't get really finish in the United Kingdom until the early hours of the morning. And this show will go off the air before there's any conclusive results. So my objective here is to just to give a flavor of it, some background information, and to create kind of a audio record of a snapshot in time of this very important election for the most important ally the United States has. What happens to their politics, obviously, has an impact certainly on our foreign policy and on our domestic policy too, because of all of the ties intellectually and culturally and so on and so forth between the United States and the United Kingdom. Trends that surface there will surface here and vice versa. So I'm going to go back to ITV and see what's going on there, and we'll be flipping back and forth throughout the evening.
Positive that we're hearing. Most of the people that we've been speaking to have been saying it looks more like a second place. And what they're saying has happened, according to their assessment, is that many Labour supporters have actually voted Conservative, they believe, tactical voting, in order to try and keep Nigel Farage out as South Thanet's Member of Parliament.
Rohit, thank you very much indeed. Now, I should say that when we said that Warwickshire North was a Labour gain, we in fact meant it was a Conservative hold. Not quite the same thing. Let's go to Nina in the opinion room.
Tom, thank you very much. So it looks like Nigel Farage isn't going to get his seat in the Commons. Matthew Goodman, you were in Thanet just on Tuesday in his constituency. Did you get the sense there that he wasn't going to overturn that 7,000-plus majority, that he wasn't going to make it?
Yeah, there were two big problems for Nigel Farage in South Thanet. One was the Labour vote, where you had a very active Labour candidate, Will Scobie, who was essentially working very hard to hold up those Labour voters which Nigel Farage needed in order to offset the risk that middle-class Conservatives in places like Sandwich and Broadstairs wouldn't go UKIP. Now, what looks like it may have happened, if he's second or third, is possibly that both Labour has held its vote up more than Farage wanted, and those Conservatives, reflecting, I think, what is a national picture, have really turned to the Conservatives and stayed loyal in order to keep Nigel Farage and UKIP out. So, you know, he said if he lost, he would resign.
Mm-hmm.
So we're in for a very interesting 48 hours.
Sophia Cannon, barrister, social justice campaigner. What's he done wrong? Did he manage expectations really badly? He talked of earthquakes. We're not getting that sense tonight.
It's the comic book persona. It's failed here. It works for Boris. It does not work for Nigel. He's not credible. And now his lieutenants are lining up. We've got Evans, we've got Flynn, and of course we've got Carswell. Mm. He's got legitimacy, he's got a seat, and he's in the reins there.
Matthew Paris. If Farage doesn't make it, and as we've said, he's already said that he will resign, what does that mean for the future of UKIP? And what does it mean for David Cameron's future if he goes back into number 10? Does this mean he can ignore the threat of UKIP and go back to a more modernising
UKIP? Well, firstly, I don't think that Nigel Farage is going to resign for long. He will resign, as he has promised to do, as he now must, but sooner or later, when UKIP seems to be floundering without him, he'll come back just as Alex Salmond did. But in the interim, I think that this would assist David Cameron if he wants to turn the Conservative Party in a rather more generous direction than it has seemed to be going in for the last few years. He's always been nervous, always looking over his shoulder at this threat from UKIP. For a little while, he doesn't have to. And this is a really good opportunity for David Cameron to seize the initiative and come across as the more generous sort of leader that he was at the beginning of his leadership of the party.
Do you agree with Matthew that Farage has done this before, hasn't he, come back to save UKIP? Can he get away with it another time?
Well, charismatic populists can get away with quite a lot. I mean, that's the lesson from European politics. But there is an interesting dynamic here, particularly in terms of the broader political context. If you put yourself in the shoes of a Eurosceptic, they've now pretty much got what they wanted, which is the prospect of a referendum on Britain's EU membership this side of 2017. They've got a Conservative leader who is going to campaign for us to remain within the EU. And I think Nigel Farage is probably looking at the broader context and also the fact that his party's been making those gains into Labour territory in the north, where you've got, you know, big elections in Wales next year, Labour's going to struggle again in Scotland next year, another series of by-elections. And, you know, having interviewed Nigel Farage a number of times, I would be amazed if he can, as Matthew says, stay away from that political context for long.
Mm. Sophia, where do people who have turned to UKIP this time, and especially in the European elections and the local elections, the protest vote, or this man that was suddenly talking directly to them, he was listening, he was talking straight when all the other guys around him weren't. Where do they go now if this is the beginning of the demise of UKIP?
It's not the demise of UKIP. The vote has risen in the north. The leader has fallen in the south. That is the subtlety here. Moreover, people want policy, not pints. What they're going to do, they're going to regroup around another strong man. The issue is that the north is going to be the UKIP stronghold, not the south. So we're going to see the vote coming further down.
Sophia, I'm going to have to break in because we're just going to have to hand you back to Tom for our next results. Tom.
Sorry, this is Renfrewshire East. This is the Scottish leader Jim Murphy's constituency. Let's hear what's going to happen to him.
The total number of votes given to each candidate was as follows. Graeme Strachan Cowie, Scottish Liberal Democrats, 1,069. Robert Malin, UK Independence Party, 888. David Andrew Montgomery, Scottish Conservative and Unionist, 12,465. James Murphy, known as Jim Murphy, Scottish Labour Party, 19,295. Kirsten Frances Oswald, Scottish National Party, 23,030.
So the SNP sweeps all before it. Jim Murphy, the Scottish Labour leader, the man who partially led the campaign against the independence referendum, on his soapbox day after day, fighting very hard, it must be said. It's certainly in that and in this election, he is out. Another staggering moment. First Douglas Alexander, then Gordon Brown's former seat, going to the SNP, and now East Renfrewshire. You probably heard Colin Rawlings talking earlier about how it was once one of the Tory party's safest seats in Scotland. It did seem as if some Tory voters were voting tactically to try and keep Jim Murphy in place. He looks quite cheery. He cannot be feeling so. I suspect he's known this moment is coming. But even so, this is a pretty extraordinary moment. We'll probably come back to hear what Jim's got to say. But, Julie, maybe you could put it into context on the battle board. I mean, it's nearly going yellow fast, but where do we put Jim Murphy's seat on this board?
Well, I mean, we'll just pull out from it there. We can see it just turned yellow as you were speaking there, Tom. It is in that far end column of the sort of swings that were necessary for the SNP to take the seats, and the SNP are practically breaking this battleground now because of the sort of swings that we're seeing amongst these seats. So we've seen Motherwell go as well above Jim Murphy's seat, and that was one of those seats the SNP always looks to. They took that briefly just after the Second World War, and then it went back to Labour. So it's one of those sort of historical seats, the SNP. Rutherglen, Tom Greatrex out, Joe Swinson out, Dumbartonshire East, John Nicholson, former journalist at ITV, has taken Dumbartonshire East for SNP. Dunfermline, as we said, you know, Kirkcaldy. I mean, we haven't even got round. We only mentioned Danny Alexander right at the beginning of the evening, didn't we? We haven't heard much on that end yet. But, you know, they're just sort of extraordinary seats to contemplate. And not only extraordinary that they've gone to the SNP, but the swings by which they're taking them are just, you know, breathtaking, frankly. And we'll just see this continue now to fill out. And we'll just see which ones are left standing. Just as we were talking there, Glasgow.
Okay. My impromptu audio here. Well, those results are very interesting. I mean, the major theme of this election is that the Labour Party in Great Britain always had Scotland as a stronghold, especially the industrial areas of Scotland around Glasgow. And I think Edinburgh was also pretty strong for them. And they are getting wiped out. The Scottish Nationalist Party took over Gordon Brown's old seat, and they just had a victory announced where the leader of the Scottish Labour Party in the Westminster Parliament has lost his seat, and it looks like the Scottish National Party is going to just win everything in Scotland, all 59 seats are very close to it. And that is going to be very, very bad blow for the Labour Party, and is going to have a huge impact on the politics of the United Kingdom going forward. Prior to those Scotland results, they had announced that Nigel Farage, who was running for a seat under he's the leader of the UK Independence Party, that he lost his bid to get a seat in Parliament, and he had said that he was going to resign from the UK Independence Party if he did not win the seat. So it looks like he's going to be out, and he's obviously a very visible and colorful personality, so there are going to be some ramifications from that. Going into this election, the conservatives, their threat to their electoral success was perceived to come from the UK Independence Party, and the conservatives seem to be weathering that pretty well. A lot of conservative voters flirted with the idea of voting for UKIP, but in the end, their calculation was, well, if we vote for UKIP in a multi-party election system where there is no proportional representation, there's the first-past-the-post system. If you vote for UKIP, that means you let the Labour candidate in, and they didn't want that, so they went home to the Conservatives. The Labour Party was perceived to be under the threat of the Scottish Nationalists in one of the strongest areas of their strength traditionally, which was Scotland, and they did not weather that threat well. Labour is being wiped out in Scotland. So of the two insurgent parties, one has clearly had a much bigger impact than the other in terms of the, you know, ultimate end of the game, which is to win seats in Parliament. My brother has called in. I'm going to just recognize him, and then we'll go back to ITV. Hey, Phil, how are you?
Hey, Bob, how you doing?
Good. Hey, is that audio coming through okay?
Yeah, the audio is coming through fine.
Okay, good. Because I don't know, it must be the codex or something. It's not as loud on this ITV feed as it is on some of the other channels. So.
No, it sounds fine over the phone, you know?
Well, anyway, I mean, it's just an incredible night. I mean, the Tories are doing much better than anybody expected, but the politics in Great Britain are going to change. And
Liberal Democrats took a beating.
Oh, yeah, they're getting wiped out, too, yeah. You know, it's kind of interesting because a lot of people in America always, you know, rant and rave about, especially on the conservative side, you know, the Republicans are this, they're wusses, they're this, they're that. We should go third party. Well, I hope they're all tuning into this election because this shows the risks of having multiple parties in an electoral system where it's the person who gets the most votes takes the seat. And all of a sudden, the calculus gets very, very complicated. Scotland, and you know, looking at the Scottish vote, the pro-union parties, Labour and Conservative, are probably going to get over half the vote or close to it, but they're not going to get any seats.
Mm.
Whereas UKIP, is probably going to get between 10 and 15% of the vote, and they're not going to get any seats. So unless you change your electoral system, third parties are just a very dicey proposition, and that's, you know, for anybody who listens to this in archive, I think that's one of the takeaways Americans should get from this election. Okay, well, let's go back to ITV and see what's going on here and get my audio back. All right, we're having issues. Thank you. it looks like the issues are over there. Ah.
I know what it's like to come from behind in an election in this constituency, and I know that you will cherish the opportunity that your victory has provided you with. I wholeheartedly congratulate you and wish you every success in your parliamentary career and standing up for the people of East Renfrewshire. As well as having had the honour of representing East Renfrewshire in Parliament, I've also had the chance to serve in governments, Labour governments, and in the Cabinet under both Tony Blair and Gordon Brown. And I'm proud of those 13 years.
So, Jim Murphy there giving a very gracious victory speech. I remember talking to him as he was pondering whether he was going to take on the leadership of the Scottish Labour Party. He certainly knew things were bad. He felt he could fight back and stood a decent chance of turning the party's fortunes around. What I don't think he even begun to imagine at that point was anything like what has happened tonight. It'll be very interesting to see whether he and Douglas Alexander, what they choose to do with their careers. Do they go on and fight in the Scottish parliamentary elections? Do they take a different path? But certainly neither of them can have imagined they would have ended up here. We haven't talked that much. I mean, Scotland is such a big story. In one sense, it's distracting us, not in any incorrect way, but away from the Labour Tory battle. And Jane, you were saying no. I was about to ask you, but we're going to go to Basildon and Billericay instead.
On Thursday, the 7th of May, 2015, I, Councillor Maureen Larkin, being the returning officer at the above election, do hereby give notice that the number of votes recorded for each candidate at the said election is as follows. Baron John Charles, the Conservative Party, 22,668 votes. Callaghan Gavin Dominic, Labour Party, 10,186 votes. Constantidis Giorgio, UK Independence Party, UKIP, 8,538 votes.
Okay, so that's a conservative hold. No surprises
Johnson,
there. But let's just have a look
Martin,
in a moment at what's happened
Adam,
to the
Liberal
UKIP
Democrat,
share of the
1,000.
We're having a transmission problem again. The feed should be back in a minute.
And East Thurrock, which itself abuts Thurrock, which I suspect now is probably the best chance of UKIP getting a seat outside the two seats they won in the by-elections in Clacton and Rochester and Strood, if, as we seem to think, Nigel Farage is not going to win Thanet South.
It is, while we're on the subject of UKIP, and we're just going to go to the opinion room, but before we do, so much is going through this evening that I keep trying to remember to mention this, but David Cameron has, of course, said that he will not walk back into Downing Street unless he can guarantee a referendum on the European Union. Well, that's quite an interesting question, given how categorically he said it, when we look at how he might have to put together alliances. But perhaps we can come back to that later in the evening. Let's go to the opinion room with Nina.
Thank you, Tom. So another really, really big Labour scalp there. Let's get some explanation, perhaps. We'll try from Elizabeth Linda from Facebook. From what you've been seeing, what explanation can you offer? Explanation?
Yeah, well, it's interesting. What we have over here is a map that's taking a look at the likes on the Labour page and where those come from. And you can see that those are primarily concentrated in metropolitan centres. Quite pale in much of the UK. Now, this is the conversational election. Mm-hmm. A few days ago, actually, the most discussed issue switched from health to the economy. How did that potentially play into what we're seeing here? Out of 60 million interactions on Facebook around the election, 14 of those were related to Labour. So there's a lot of questions here about what we're seeing tonight.
Right, so the major topics swapped in the last few days, Elizabeth. Mm-hmm. Thank you. So let's get some more thoughts, really, on what seems to be a very bad night for Labour. What has gone wrong? I'm joined once again by Owen Jones, Isabel Hardman and Jenny Russell, but also I've been joined by Martin Lewis. You know him, of course, as the financial expert, journalist and campaigner. Thank you for joining us this evening. If I start with you, Owen, I mean, where to start? I know you've briefly touched on this previously, but now being the evidence, I suppose, of these, you know, big scalps, Jim Murphy.
Absolutely. Well, look, the catastrophe of Scotland is unforgivable. This is the heartland of the Labour Party. Scotland provided many of the first leaders of the Labour Party. Mm. Its roots are very much in that nation. And Keir Hardie, the founding leader of the Labour Party, himself a Scot like so many others, they formed an alliance, the Labour Party, with the Tories during the Better Together campaign. It was a campaign, I'm afraid, whatever you think about independence, based on fear. And it caused a absolute calamitous collapse in support amongst traditional Scottish Labour voters who defected en masse. And I often say about those ex-Scottish Labour voters, they have the bitterness of ex-lovers and the zealotry of the convert. They hate Labour. They regard them as the Red Tories. And this is a disaster. And I spoke to a leading member of the Scottish Labour camp back in September. They said that decision by Labour to form that alliance with the Tories was a mistake of historic proportions. Well, we see now
punishment.
What those proportions
punishment
have
tonight.
Turned
We've had
out
a
to
tweet
be.
From the Labour MP, John Mann. You can read it for yourself. Can't say that Labour leadership weren't warned repeatedly. Those who even bothered to meet that. It never hurts to listen. Jenny, did they not listen? There were huge concerns about Ed Miliband.
That has been the common theme of almost everybody who's outside the inner circle in the Labour Party over the past 4 years. Mm. There are lots of people who wished Ed Miliband well, and even when he won the leadership against other candidates, were willing to work to support him. But the leadership was very insular, and it didn't turn to all the people within the Labour Party, ex-advisers and MPs and peers and so on, all of whom who wanted to talk to them on whatever area of expertise they had. They didn't consult widely. Tony Blair had this explicit policy of going out and building what he called a big tent, bringing on board all kinds of people, even people who weren't natural Labour supporters. And I'm afraid that the Labour leadership, who were convinced that they had the right answers, if only they could just sit still and quietly long enough to find them, did the exact opposite. They presided over what was a shrunken centre. So that, as John Mann says, there were so many people who tried to meet with them, to talk to them about where they were going on with business, with Europe, with welfare, and the Labour leadership didn't reach out to them.
And did they get caught up in the campaign where, from the first television set piece, he did a lot better than people expected, and did that lead them down a path where they thought that this was going to be all right, he was going to be the next Prime Minister?
I think certainly that's what people thought, and of course we all thought that, because suddenly in the last 6 weeks or so, Ed Miliband found the kind of confident public voice that has eluded him for the past four and a half years. But I think the problem with that was that the Labour leadership had spent so long sitting and planning their future and not going out and talking to people and not convincing people and creating the right image and crafting a message that people would want to listen to over the previous few years, when people were desperate to hear something different. And they didn't come out with it then, and they're paying the price for having left that vacuum now.
Isabel, you're nodding.
Yeah, I think there's also been an assumption on the part of the Labour Party that voters are still its voters, and it doesn't need to bother knocking on their door. That's certainly been
even with the 5 million conversations.
Well,
the
some of those came too late, I think. There were Scottish constituencies which have been neglected for years. There were Scottish MPs, Scottish Labour MPs, who would boast that their candidates.
Okay, I'm going to take a break from the TV for now and just make a couple of other remarks. One of the things that struck me about this broadcast was they have experts analyzing conversations on Twitter and Facebook as a way of, you know, being kind of like a political weather vane to see the trends of public opinion. That's kind of interesting how, you know, these social media platforms, you know, 10 years ago did not exist, and now they have spawned whole new industries. So I thought that's kind of interesting. And the commentary there on the ITV is about the labor wipeout in Scotland. I mean, you just cannot overemphasize the importance of that. And from what I'm seeing on Twitter, reading tweets from various people commenting on the election, it looks like, you know, just across the board, the Conservatives are doing better than they were expected. The seats that they were expected to win, they're winning by bigger majorities than they had expected. The seats that were marginal, or they have a better shot at, and they've taken some of them. So this might be, a relatively good night for the Conservatives. I mean, not only will they emerge as the biggest party, but they may do that in a way that is more intense than was expected. Prior to the election, the polls had them either running absolutely neck and neck with Labour or just a point or two ahead, and it looks like in the final analysis, when people had to make the complicated decisions that you have to make when you have all these parties running, how do you vote tactically and strategically? It looks like a lot of their vote came home and a lot of Labour votes didn't. So, Phil, are you watching anything else on?
No, I've got just BBC on right now.
BBC actually became an issue all by itself in this campaign.
Really?
Oh, yeah. There was a lot of criticism directed at the BBC for biased coverage. The Conservatives complained about it, and UKIP complained about it, and it's pretty accepted in, you know, the British political circles that the BBC does have a left bias, but it is becoming more of an issue there. So I don't know. I mean, this is just kind of interesting.
Does he hold Cameron?
Do what?
Does he keep his? Does he return?
Well, you don't know until you know how many seats that he's won, because the way this system works is they have to present a program to Parliament when Parliament meets again, and if. The British don't have a written constitution, so everything is very informal. The tradition is that the largest party usually is called on to make the effort to form a government, and they have to submit their proposals in Parliament and carry them by a majority. And if they do, then that government is seated. And because of the closeness of this election, it really depends upon, if he wins an absolute majority, then there's not a problem. But if he falls short of an absolute majority, when he presents his program, he has to get smaller parties to vote for his program, or at least enough of them to abstain so that it gets carried. And no one will really know until probably, you know, mid-morning U.S. time what the situation is regarding. So
yeah, well, that's what they said before. Tonight. They said 6 o'clock, 7 o'clock this morning, maybe.
Yeah.
They'll have a clearer picture.
Yeah. So it's, it's kind of confusing. And again, I mean, this is what when you have this situation with all these small parties who win seats, and no party has a majority, it gets very, very complicated. So there's a lot of horse trading that goes on.
Well, they're saying, BBC is saying they're going to be short by 10 seats of an all-out majority.
Yeah, and so the likeliest way for them to get a majority is that in the current government they had a coalition with the Liberal Democrats. Of course, now the Liberal Democrats are getting wiped out. So are there enough Liberal Democrats left to form a coalition with the Conservatives? And do the Liberal Democrats want to form a coalition with the Conservatives? Because politically, that the first coalition was so costly for them. And then there are these Irish parties, unionist parties in Northern Ireland, that the Conservatives could conceivably tack on to their attempt to form a majority, and then there is whatever UKIP wins. So who knows? I mean, this is the British version of hanging chads in Florida.
Yeah.
And it's all made possible by the emergence of these third parties, especially the Scottish Nationalists, because with a relatively small sliver of the total national vote, they're going to get almost 10% of the seats because of the way the first-past-the-post system works. And, you know, I'm going to go back to ITV in a second, but it was the Labour Party, especially Tony Blair, which made such a point of devolving power to Scotland and Wales, and I think, you know, he created kind of a monster in terms of his own political party, because these nationalist movements really took off with encouragement from Labour, and they've grown so great that, you know, now they're destroying Labour, especially in Scotland. And then, of course, the other thing that is a big factor in Scotland is the Labour Party in Scotland and the voters in Scotland are very left-wing, and the Labour Party got very damaged up there when it, because of the Iraq War, that was one of the factors that started the decline of Labour in Scotland. So that was a lot of chickens coming home to roost here. So I'm going to go back to ITV, and hopefully I won't have the same problem with my audio that I had before.
Through the night, and I'm very hopeful that in a number of seats we'll be making gains.
Would you accept that the Labour Party is going to have to ask itself some pretty searching questions any which way after tonight? It looks as if you've almost entirely lost Scotland. A frankly pretty much unbelievable development in the history of the Labour Party, if that does turn out to be the case. Ed himself argued very openly that he was trying to win an election from the left. He never made any big secret of that. Is it time to get back to something like Tony Blair's big tent mentality? Is that what you need to do to be more centrist as a party in order to win?
Look, what's happened in Scotland, and tonight I've, you know, already lost some friends who've lost their seats. They are friends, and they were very good MPs, and I'm very disappointed for them and for Scottish Labour activists who've been working very hard. I mean, look, there'll be a lot of discussion after tonight. Clearly, in Scotland, some of this is to do from the momentum that happened in the referendum. But I'm actually very proud of Jim Murphy and how he stepped up to be leader. And in a short space of time, I think he was making an impact. But clearly, we've had a situation over the last 6 weeks where the SNP have been bigged up constantly by the Tories and David Cameron. And clearly what is happening tonight is every SNP gain is contributing to what we've warned about, giving David Cameron closer access to the keys
of Number 10. As far as our policies are concerned, look, we are a progressive party, but we understand that also, in line with social justice, we need to have a strong economy. And, you know, I don't see anything that is, if you like, too left-wing about saying that we can have a successful economy not by having a race to the bottom, but by ensuring that the vast majority of working people on middle and low income can feel that they're succeeding as well. I actually think most British people actually believe in that too, but, you know, it's a long night ahead, and as is the case with every election, there'll be discussion later on.
It is a long night ahead indeed. Caroline Flint, thank you very, very much indeed for taking the time to join us. Let's have a look at the full results in Kingston and Surbiton, where Ed Davey has just gone out, rather surprisingly. I say rather surprisingly. It's not surprising given what's happened the last few hours. It probably was at the start of the evening. Colin and Jane, maybe I can bring you in here. Just have a look at the change in the share of the vote here.
It's just
remarkably similar pattern, really.
Yeah, fascinating. And obviously, as Colin said many times, you know, there's lots of churn under the surface there. There's people going in and out of different parties. But we know that Liberal Democrat voters have gone to Labour. They've gone to the Conservatives. They've gone to the Greens, and they've gone to UKIP, and here's a seat where, you know, that combined effect is the loss of a Liberal Democrat MP.
Can I ask you something? Of the Liberal Democrat voters that you think remain, what would they want their remaining 10 MPs to do?
So of the remaining Conservative, and so the remaining Liberal Democrats who have stayed with the Conservative and Liberal coalition, half, some of them, almost about, there's an equal split between those who would like a Conservative-led coalition, presumably with the Lib Dems, and those who would like a Labour-led coalition with the Lib Dems. So in a sense, you know, some of those Liberal Democrat voters who have remained are a little bit more favourable to the Conservatives. It's almost by definition, those who have kind of lasted the distance of 5 years are, relatively speaking, more happy with the Conservative coalition. But that isn't to
complicated,
say...
Complicated, though, isn't it? That makes their life very complicated, doesn't it?
But also, they don't want to just be on that rump of Lib Dem support. I mean, one of the things we also know is that those people who look like they were sticking with the Lib Dems are the kind of people that have been with the Lib Dems for years and years and years. They'd voted Lib Dem in 2005, they'd voted Lib Dem in 2010. The Liberal Democrats don't just want to stick on that level of support, of course. They want to get back to the levels where they were in 2010 and 2005 with other Labour voters and so on and so forth. So I don't think what the Liberal Democrats can do is only look to the current supporters. They've got to broaden out. They've got to go back to those voters who have deserted them. And most of those voters who have deserted them have gone to Labour, they've gone to the Greens, and some have gone to Conservatives and UKIP. But on the largest majority of the voters they've lost, those voters are more on the left. And, you know, I think, therefore, staying in coalition with a Conservative government that's committed to further austerity would be extremely difficult.
They've got to go back 45 years. We're talking now about the Liberal Party, as was then in 1970, when the joke was that they could all fit in a taxi. It may be bigger than that now, but it's certainly they'll all fit in a minibus. And in 1970, they didn't really have very much influence on British politics. And since then, under Jeremy Thorpe, then under Paddy Ashton, under Nick Clegg, they began to build and build and build, not in a continual line, but in a, you know, progress was clearly being seen over that 45-year period. And then suddenly tonight, woof, right? And it will come as a terrible shock.
I have to say, it's not suddenly tonight. I mean, this happened in 2010. You know, the Liberal Democrats haven't been losing lots of extra votes over the campaign. We're just seeing the culmination of that
process. I can interject some good news for the Liberal Democrats. We are calling Orkney and Shetland as Liberal Democrat.
Excellent. Poland. And so they've got one seat in Scotland and one seat in Wales because they held Ceredigion. So they've lost Cardiff Central to Labour and Brecon and Radnor. I wonder how many they'll end up with in England to add to those two.
It is possible that Alistair Carmichael, the Scottish Secretary in Orkney, may be the sole survivor in this earthquake. A good moment to go to Julie for a summary.
Yes, let's catch up with some of that, shall we? The SNP, as we've been hearing, are making significant gains in Scotland, but our exit poll puts the Conservatives on the most seats, but not enough for a majority. According to the exit poll, the Tories will finish on 316 seats. Labour will be way behind on 239. 10 seats for the Lib Dems, we're just hearing, 2 each for UKIP and the Green Party. The SNP are forecast to have 58 seats. Plaid to have four. And as we've seen, the SNP are making major gains tonight, including from some Labour and Lib Dem heavyweights. In Paisley in Renfrewshire South, Labour's election chief and former Shadow Foreign Secretary Douglas Alexander has lost his seat to 20-year-old student Mary Black. Scottish Labour leader Jim Murphy is also out in Renfrewshire East. Well, Mr Alexander spoke after his loss to address the challenges ahead for Labour, followed by a victory speech from Ms Black, who becomes the youngest elected MP since the 17th century. SNP leader Nicola Sturgeon said Labour have brought the losses on themselves.
This, of course, has been a very difficult night for Labour. Scotland has chosen to oppose this Conservative government, but not place that trust in the Labour Party. It will be our responsibility to rewin that trust in the months and years ahead.
Thank you very much.
The people of Scotland are speaking, and it is time for their voice to be heard at Westminster. I make this promise to the constituents of Paisley and Renfrewshire South. That is exactly what I plan to do. Thank you very much.
Yeah, we are witnessing something that is historic. It hasn't happened overnight. It hasn't even happened in the 7 months since the referendum, although undoubtedly that has accelerated this process. But Labour's been losing touch with the people of Scotland and losing the trust of the people of Scotland now for many, many years. They haven't listened, and I think what they are suffering tonight, although I've got personal sympathy for everybody who is losing their seat, what they are suffering tonight as a party is down to them.
Mr. Sturgeon speaking a little while ago. Some of the other seats taken by the SNP include Kirkcaldy, Cowdenbeath, Gordon Brown, former constituency, Dunbartonshire West, Dunbartonshire East, where Joe Swinson, the Lib Dem Employment Minister, lost, Dundee West, Kilmarnock and Loudoun, and Glenrothes, where the SNP share increased by 38%. Elsewhere, the Lib Dems are losing seats to both the Tories and to Labour. The Conservatives have just taken Ed Davies' seat in Kingston and Surbiton, plus Colchester, and Brecon and Radnorshire from their coalition partners, while Labour have taken Burnley, Cardiff Central and Redcar from the Lib Dems. Those are the key developments in the last hour. Lots of results now coming in. We just saw that Carlisle, a key target, is now a Conservative hold. That's a key target for Labour. Many more results coming in very shortly. Tom.
Julie, thank you.
Okay, I just wanted to make a couple of remarks about the last thing that I just mentioned on ITV, which was the Liberal Democrats are getting it from both sides. I mean, conservatively inclined. The Liberal Democrats position themselves as the centrist party in this election. But the problem with that was that for more conservatively aligned voters who were afraid of a Labour government, they decided to vote strategically and vote conservative, even though their first choice might have been the Liberal Democrats. And the kind of left-wing Liberal Democrats who did not like the austerity program that the Conservatives did in the last parliament abandoned the Liberal Democrats and went over to Labour. So when you straddle the middle ground, you're exposed to attacks on both sides, and that seems to be what is happening to the Liberal Democrats, a very bad night for them. I'll go back to ITV.
This is the obviously, I mean, here's the surprising thing, they won that in the by-election.
The Conservatives by not having a great campaign or a great candidate, and with UKIP more in their pomp then, and it looks as if they have been this evening. But again, you know, that it's in the pattern, and I think, say, with Brent Central, and Dawn Butler, of course, is what's rather inelegantly called a retread. She used to be the MP for that constituency. The boundaries changed, and she lost to Sarah Tether, who's an assiduous constituency MP. And I think as soon as Sarah Tether said she would stand down, everybody assumed it was going to be a Labour gain. They didn't assume it was going to be a near 30% swing from Lib Dem to Labour.
I mean, when do you think we will have a
move from that? We've talked about the exit poll. We've seen a lot of seats. Not that I want to put you on the spot, but at what point do you think we move towards updating the exit poll? Is it another hour or so? Or I'm sorry to be boring on this subject, Tom. You're never boring. But can we interject this at this point in the evening? But I think, first thing to say, we've had, about a quarter of the results or something of that kind, but we haven't had a sufficient variety of them across the country. England, I was saying earlier, is slow to count because of the local elections. So I would think perhaps, 30 maybe, we may think of adjusting what the exit poll says to make it a more results-based forecast. Yeah. But I would reiterate to you that nothing we have seen so far suggests that the exit poll is fundamentally wrong in any of the things it basically said, which was the SNP would sweep Scotland's tick. That's already happened. That the Liberal Democrats would take a hammer in and be lucky to win a dozen seats. Nor, perhaps most crucially, that the Conservatives would be pretty close to an effective majority, if not quite there, perhaps. At some point, there's going to be a bit of an investigation as to how you managed to get your exit poll so right and everyone else gets it so incredibly wrong during the campaign. Or do you think there was much late movement? Late swing is always what it's called. I don't know what the pollsters will say. I don't know that we had Andrew Hawkins on earlier talking about sort of methodological differences between phone polls and internet polls, for example. Internet polls often rely on a panel of people to whom they keep going back, and in the trade, Jane will know this better than I, they talk of panel effects. If you know you're on a panel of a poll, you're waiting for it to come in, and perhaps if you're being paid 50p to fill in a survey, that has an impact on how you look at politics, how you ingest the news. Telephone polls tend much more to be random.
The truth is, we never really know whether this is a last-minute swing or whether the polls were wrong. I mean, one of the arguments tonight is that there were lots of shy Tories, you know, lots of Conservatives who weren't coming out and saying they were going to vote Tory. But the kind of scale of the differences between the polls and the results that we're seeing, you know, this is going to have to be investigated. We're not seeing a large difference in terms of the vote shares and of the two major parties, and certainly those vote shares looked very, very stable, but that translation into seats, this wasn't predicted, and much of that was because people assumed that Liberal Democrats would hold on where they'd been strongest, and I have to say... ..hands up. You know, the ex... ..of Colin, obviously, on the team.
Great, Colin. Let's go to Nina in the opinion room to discuss...
Tom, thank you. Well, after that, as you called it, catastrophic result there for the Lib Dems in Brent Central, let's focus for Craig. I'm joined once again by Graham Sharp from William Hill. What are his chances of holding on to Sheffield Hallam?
Well, we think now we're looking at three potential leadership campaigns, and there's a little bit of good news for Nick Ligon. Because he's 20-1 on favourite to win in Sheffield Hallam.
Okay.
That's the shortest price it's been since the whole campaign began. Precisely. But even should he do that, which we expect him to do, then almost certainly the victory of Tim Farron recently presages a leadership campaign, and we already make Tim Farron 1-3 favourites. If another potential candidate, the Liberal Democrat leaders, we are odds on that they finish with 10 or fewer MPs in total at the moment, but Norman Lamb is the second favourite at 5-1, and the third favourite is Vince Cable. Ed Davey would have been, but he's gone, and even Danny Alexander, he a contender, but he looks like going. So it's looking at a three-horse race between those three.
Thank you. Well, let's get some analysis now from Vince Cable, mentioned there, his former advisor, Giles Wilkes. I'm also joined once again by Jenny Russell and by the Lib Dems.
It's a bit too soon to speculate. I know you hear that all the time, but Nick Clegg doesn't know how many MPs he's leading right now, although the exit poll has been blinding good, which suggests it's going to be 10 or 12. Now, he's, in my view, head and shoulders. It's very hard to spot how Nick Clegg has behaved, and the electors of Sheffield apparently agree. So he ought to be a contender to lead this party, because he's shown how you can do it in the most difficult circumstances of all. But no party leader has ever lost so many seats in one election. Mm. So he will have to be doing some thinking about it for sure.
Jenny, not a Liberal Democrat supporter, but you wrote an article recently about Nick Clegg saying he was the most underrated, over-criticised, misunderstood politician in Britain. Do you think he will be judged more kindly when we look back on this coalition? People said it wouldn't last 5 minutes, it wouldn't last a year, whatever your politics, it was a stable coalition for 5 years.
He ought to be judged very well, because he could have chosen not to go into coalition with the Conservatives, and that would have been the easy option. He would have left his party looking like a pure party of opposition. But actually at the time, I think what we forget is that we were all terribly scared about the world economy and about the stability of Britain, whether we'd have to pay a great deal of money on our debt, whether a coalition government could possibly be coherent or stable. And Clegg went in, took the risk of being in government. He knew already that minority parties are usually punished by electorates at the end of their term. He acted in the national interest, not really in the interest of the Liberal Democrats. He was a very faithful supporter of the coalition, and now he's being punished because, having had to do what all coalitions have to do, which is give up some of your preferred policies because you have to accommodate yourself to your coalition partners, especially when you're the minority, then the British public believed this whole narrative of betrayal over tuition fees. And frankly, the Tories have got a lot to answer for here, because they were prepared to propagate this myth that he had lied to people over tuition fees. No, he hadn't. He just had to give up a policy because he was a minority party in a majority government. And if only the Britons were more grown up about this, we would have recognised that, of course, he had to do this. It was absolutely outrageous to pretend that he lied and cheated. It's equivalent to saying that the Tories were able to say, as if this were a marriage, that this was a wife who hadn't done what they were supposed to do, and then they say, look, she lied and she cheated when they bullied her into something.
And your colleague Daniel Finkelstein, who was on earlier, he said of Nick Clegg that actually he was he's a really good politician because he realised that he'd made a mistake on tuition fees, and he was able to rectify that. And in that situation, with the financial situation, he thought that the Tories' plan was a better move.
The thing about Clegg is that he's an honest politician and he's rational, and if anyone's heard him talking over the last few days, they know that he's honest about his mistakes and he's very open about them.
Jenny,
and yet the British public don't recognise it.
They're wanting me to hand back just briefly for you. Clearly Clegg is being punished by votes. Will he be punished by his own party now?
He doesn't deserve to be. He's fought a terrific campaign. He's been tireless in promoting the things he believes in, and he's got a very good deal for Lib Dem policies during 5 years in office.
OK, well, of course, return to Nick Clegg when we get the results from Sheffield.
Nina, thank you very much. Now, Ed Miliband, the Labour leader, has just left his home and is on the way to his camp, wife Justine. I'd love to know what he's thinking at this point in the evening. I'm very, very optimistic indeed in the run-up to the election. Seemed optimistic today. He spoke to some of his staff today who seemed to feel that it was going well. But as we've said often during the course of the campaign, no one really knows anything. Apart from Colin here, he turns out to know quite a lot. But thank God for that. And Jane, we've got some people here who've actually really known what they were talking about. Out of business. Now let's not nearly enough about Wales, so let's just go and take a look at what has been happening there. So far, Labour have won 21. Maybe we can see the change in terms of who's lost and who's won. Basically, to some extent, that's the story of the night. Not a huge amount of change in terms of Labour Conservative, but the Liberal Democrats down, and there it seems to have. Conservatives seem to have picked up. Now, we have Adrian Masters in Cardiff, who can put this into perspective for us. Adrian, what's happening in Wales in terms of overall picture?
Something rather extraordinary, I think, Tom, because you're quite right, it fits in with the UK picture, but to all intents and purposes, the Conservatives were quite happy on what they were expecting, which was going to be around about 8 seats. They're doing way better than this. Picking up the seat that they expected to gain, which was Brecon and Radnor, but some that, frankly, even the Conservatives here in Wales didn't think they were going to win. So Vale of Clwyd, after a recount, went to them, and there's a recount in Gower, and there's every chance here in Cardiff, the seat of Cardiff North, which was Conservative, pretty much everybody, including the Conservatives, have given up on that. That's now heading very close and is described as being on a knife's edge and could well be in recount territory. We'll find out that fairly soon, actually, here at the county of Cardiff. So on the one hand, it's a very good night for the Conservatives, much better than they expected to do here in Wales. That means, correspondingly, that it's been a bad night for Labour, although, of course, they are still on course to become remain the largest party and pick up a couple of seats here in Wales, because it has been a ropey night for the Lib Dems here at Cardiff. One of their most senior figures, the former government whip, Jenny Willis, just lost her seat to Labour. The big question is about Welsh nationalists talking all night about Scottish nationalists. That doesn't seem to have translated to any kind of gains for Leanne Wood's party, Plaid Cymru, here in Wales. They're doing well. They look like they're going to keep their three seats, but they're not going to pick up any others. In fact, there was a big disappointment for them just now. They had a recount on Ynysmon, on the Isle of Anglesey. That's now a Labour hold. Also, a very disappointing.
Okay. I just want to make a couple of remarks about that. The commentator was talking about the Tories doing better than they expected to in Wales, and that seems to be the trend of the evening, that they're doing better than they expected everywhere. Even in terms of what the exit polls suggested, it looks like they're doing better than what the exit polls suggested, which was just taken a few hours ago. I guess they're going to do another round of exit polling, will be released in a few hours. Of course, that will be long after this show. The three things that just occurred to me looking at Twitter and social media, one was Barack Obama's political advisor, David Axelrod, had a very big role in this election. He spent a lot of time over in England and came up with a lot of questionable publicity stunts. And one of the ones, I don't know how directly he was involved in this one, but Ed Miliband, the leader of the Labour Party, had campaign promises put on what was supposed to be a mock-up of stone tablets, and it was released into the media, as a sort of a message that you could take these promises to the bank. They're written in stone. Well, that got a lot of flack in the media. A lot of people satirized it. And it looks like the magic of the Obama machine and his advisors did not translate well across the Atlantic. I think one of the reasons why these polls are all over the place and then turned out to be so inaccurate is that when you have a situation where you're inclined to support one party, but you know that party is not going to win enough seats to form a government, all of a sudden the calculus gets very unpredictable. And I think that that's what occurred here. Nobody knew for sure how many of the UKIP voters would defect from the Conservatives and vote for UKIP. Well, it looks like the Conservatives held on to a lot of UKIP-inclined voters, and nobody knew the same thing with as far as the Scottish Nationalists and Labour, but there, Labour voters did defect to the Scottish Nationalists and in very massive quantities. So again, when you don't have a two-party system anymore, polling becomes very, very, very difficult, that I think that's going to be widely discussed in the aftermath of this election. And finally, on the Liberal Democrats, I was thinking about a way of explaining this strange character of that party, and the thing that occurred to me is that if you think of a California liberal in the affluent parts of California, Silicon Valley, San Francisco, that type of California liberal libertarian voter, that gives you sort of a parallel to the kind of voters that the liberal Democrats tend to have. Now, obviously, that's an analogy, and no analogy is perfect. But I think that's a way of describing what that, getting an understanding of what that party is about. And there is a lot of schizophrenia in the Liberal Democratic Party. And in the past number of years, they were very left-wing when it came to Iraq. They were very critical about the whole war on terror, the infringements on civil liberty, the involvement in Iraq, that kind of thing. Back in the day under Tony Blair, their constant criticism of him was that he wasn't spending enough on social programs. But then when the British economy went off the cliff and it looked like the taxes would have to be raised, the Liberal Democrats, which is an upper middle class party, all of a sudden just switched gears and got very concerned about financial propriety and stability and getting the deficit down, and they made their deal with the conservatives. So they've been wandering all over the political landscape, and one of the problems is when you wander like that, you start eroding your brand image, your identity. People just don't trust you for various reasons, and that's apparently what happened to them, and they really went off a cliff in this election. So, and just looking at Twitter, it looks like George Galloway, talk about a demagogue who was pro-Iraq, pro-Saddam Hussein, it looks like he lost his seat, which is a bit of a cleansing of the public square, so that's good news. Those are the points I wanted to make. I'm probably going to end this broadcast in a few minutes because it just from reading what I'm reading on Twitter and listening to the commentary, although the conservatives are doing better than expected, a lot of these seats in England results are not going to be known until a couple of hours from now, and I don't want to just drone on unnecessarily. So I'll probably end the broadcast in about 15 minutes, and I think I'll go back to ITV.
Sanae Sarfazida, who has been this iconic figure for them. Let's go to Bermondsey. Simon Hughes' constituency. Hold on.
We understand that the Lib Dems have lost Hornsey and Wood Green to Labour anyway. Lynn Featherston,
yeah. Right, okay. Well, this is, we're just waiting here for Simon Hughes. You probably saw him earlier in the evening talking to us, been the MP here ever since 1983. Certainly until we got to tonight, I think generally all thought of him as a very well dug in MP who'd be very, very hard to shift indeed.
This has got to be one of the tests, hasn't it, of the incumbency factor the Lib Dems are relying on.
Very important Liberal Democratic seat up here.
Thank you.
1,146.
Corner of your screen there, Liberal Democrat safe seat, not anymore. Simon Hughes is out. And what's more, by the looks of it, he is convincingly out of the picture there, convincing Labour gain.
17,657. Levin, William.
4,500 votes in it on our quick calculation. Although Tom Brake's constituency, Carl Shelton, and Wallington, it looks like the Liberal Democrats have held on. There are two stories there, really. Well, let's just have a look at what's happened in Bermondsey, and particularly at the change in the share of the vote. Ben, Colin?
So sometime before this evening, this would happen quite a lot more, but actually the Liberal Democrats are losing votes, sorry, seats to Conservatives in greater measure, but this is a seat where if there was going to be a seat where we thought that a sitting MP would have been able to hold on even by their fingernails, then I think it would have been Simon Hughes in Bermondsey. And certainly Simon Hughes was known to be a party on the, you know, somewhere on the left of his party, the kind of MP that should have appealed to the Labour voters who have, in fact, you know, won these votes from the Liberal Democrats. I mean, it's just extraordinary. Those Liberal Democrats have moved over to Labour instead of sticking with Simon Hughes. And this is, you know, certainly, I think, one of the big stories of this evening.
It sounds as if Nick Clegg has arrived at his seat in Sheffield Hallam not very long ago. Hard to know from the pictures we're seeing what he's thinking, but I spent a bit of time with Nick Clegg on the campaign and a lot before it, and I can honestly say I don't think it entered his head for a single second that he'd be down to 10 MPs by the end of this evening. Quite amazing, really. We're also told that Alex Salmond has won his seat in Jordan. I think on the terms of what's happening elsewhere in Scotland, it would have been completely startling if he had won it. Nevertheless, he will be back, and I think we can safely say causing David Cameron trouble at Westminster. Certainly there's no love lost whatsoever between the two men. Alexander, of course, will not be the leader of the SNP contingent at Westminster. We're just waiting to hear Simon Hughes here and what he will or won't have to say in this moment. As I was saying, Alexander will not, in fact, be the leader. Well, not as far as we know, will not be the leader of the SNP contingent at Westminster. No doubt he will be a particularly articulate spokesman. He's only taken quite a lot of pleasure in winding up the various points. Let's go to Gordon and hear what's happened there.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm a petition to declare the results for Gordon's constituency. From a total vote cast of 50.
Okay, well, that was a very big win for the Labour Party, and part of the theme of the evening, the Liberal Democrats getting hammered on all sides. And, you know, having watched British politics for a long time, you know, to me, there's a certain karma in that, because they've been on all sides of many, many issues over the past 15 years. They were very instrumental in helping the Labour Party wipe out the Conservatives back in 1997. And, you know, what goes around comes around. You know, I'm sure they mean well, and there are cycles in politics that, you know, cannot be escaped. But, you know, any electoral strategy deteriorates over time, and eventually you get defeated. So it looks like it's their turn for the evening. We're having a raging thunderstorm going on in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, so I think I'm going to get off the phone here. The show is only going to last another 15 minutes anyway. Like I said, based on when all of these key results are going, the big numbers are just not going to be known for a couple of hours. And even after they're known, since the conservatives are in all likelihood going to fall just short of a majority, the coalition building and horse trading, the results of all that may not be known for a couple of days. So I'm going to just take this opportunity to sign off. Hey, Phil, I want to thank you for dropping by.
Okay, Bob.
And I'm going to go out with a a clip from the British equivalent of House of Cards, which was a television series done in the 1990s, also named House of Cards, about a scheming, unscrupulous prime minister who undermines his opponents and gets a stranglehold on power. And the prime minister is Francis Urquhart, and just after he topples the existing prime minister, he has this little aside with the audience. So I'll go out with that, and we'll call it an evening.
Not feeling guilty, I hope. If you have pangs of pity, crush them now. Grind them under your heel like old cigar butts. I've done the country a favor. He didn't have the brain or the heart or the stomach to rule a country like Great Britain. A nice enough man, but there was no bottom to him. His deepest need was that people should like him. An admirable trait that, in a spaniel or a whore, not, I think, in a prime minister. And we've done him a favor, too, if you did but know it. He was in the trap and screaming from the moment he took office. You simply put the poor bastard out of his agony. After life's fitful fever, he sleeps well. So let's not indulge ourselves in any squeamishness. All right? Because this is just the start. You saw them. You saw their eyes that glitter around the table. Samuels, Wooten, Harold L., Mackenzie. And every one of them will have to understand that I have their measure, that I put the stick about. I watch them jump.
On that note, good night all. We'll be back in a week or two with another show. Have a great evening.
All right, Bob. Good night.
Bye. Night.